Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for July 24th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines, Valiant State, and USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, Trump Announces Japan Trade Deal. President Donald Trump says his administration has secured a long-sought trade deal with Japan that includes lowering the steep U.S. tariff the country faced under the looming August 1st deadline, when higher levies for countries across the world are set to go into effect. I just signed the largest trade deal in history, I think maybe the largest deal in history, with Japan, Trump said the night of July 22nd during a White House reception with Republican lawmakers. Japan is the fourth largest trading partner of the United States, behind Canada, Mexico, and China. Trump said the United States will impose a 15% tariff on Japanese imports under the agreement, which he hailed as a massive deal in a post on Truth Social. He had previously threatened a 24% tariff on Japan beginning August 1st. Trump did not disclose the full details of the deal, but said Japan would invest $550 billion into the United States, with the United States receiving 90% of the profits. He said Japan also agreed to open its country to trade on products that include vehicles, rice, and other agricultural products. This is a very exciting time for the United States of America, and especially for the fact that we will continue to always have a great relationship with the country of Japan, Trump said. Speaking early July 23rd in Tokyo, Japanese Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba said he had received an initial report from his trade negotiator in Washington, but declined to comment on the specifics of the negotiation. Trump officials had suggested being close to a deal with Japan ever since the president in April postponed sweeping reciprocal tariffs on goods from most countries. Since then, the Trump administration has imposed a lower 10% universal tariff on goods from most countries, including Japan. But Trump set an August 1st deadline for the higher tariff rates on some 170 countries to kick in. The Japan announcement came after the president earlier in the day touted a new trade deal with the Philippines. The Southeast Asian country will pay a 19% tariff, Trump said hours after the country's president, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., visited the Oval Office ahead of the reciprocal tariffs deadline. President Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines is just leaving the White House with all of his many representatives. It was a beautiful visit, and we concluded our trade deal, whereby the Philippines is going open market with the United States and zero tariffs. The Philippines will pay a 19% tariff, he wrote on Truth Social. According to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, in 2024, the U.S. goods trade deficit with the Philippines was $4.9 billion, a 21.8% increase from 2023. Top U.S. exports to the Philippines include agricultural goods, machinery, cereals, and materials for semiconductor and transport equipment manufacturing. Trump's three other trade deals are with the United Kingdom, Vietnam, and Indonesia. The next article is titled, Restaurant Raids Not a Worry for Trade Group. The head of Arizona's Restaurant Association is not worried that the federal immigration raid at several Colt Grill Northern Arizona locations signals that ICE has started widespread restaurant raids in the state. The July 15th raid by federal agents involves allegations of illegal hiring practices against the owners of Colt Grill that are far outside the norm in Arizona's restaurant industry, said Steve Chukri, president and CEO of the Arizona Restaurant Association. The restaurant industry depends on immigrants to do jobs others are often unwilling to do, Chukri said. Most restaurants follow state and federal laws to hire legal workers, but sometimes learn through Social Security Administration notices that some workers may be unauthorized, Chukri said. We see that time and again, where restaurants unintentionally hire immigrant workers not authorized to work in the U.S. despite following employment verification laws, Chukri said. But that is not what we have here in the federal investigation of Colt Grill, Chukri said. We have someone that appears to have been very willful in neglecting the process, and it falls far outside the lines of what we as an industry believe should be proper hiring protocols for restaurants. The Colt Grill investigation, Chukri said, appears to be more about bad actors performing badly than ICE carrying out raids against random restaurants. On July 15th, federal agents from Homeland Security Investigations, which is part of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, raided four Colt Grill barbecue and spirits locations in Prescott, Prescott Valley, the Village of Oak Creek, Sedona, and Cottonwood in northern Arizona, and one Colt Grill location in Foley, Alabama. Federal agents arrested the owners of the restaurants, Robert and Brenda Clouston, both 61, and two others, Luis Pedro Rogel Jimenez, 33, and Iris Romero Molina, 29, on charges of conspiracy to transport illegal aliens, conspiracy to harbor illegal aliens, conspiracy to encourage and induce an alien to unlawfully enter the U.S., and a pattern of practice of knowingly employing unauthorized aliens. The federal grand jury indictment accuses the Clustons, along with Rogel Jimenez and Romero Molina, of taking part in a scheme to pay to have undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. to work in the restaurants, creating a cleaning company to pay the unauthorized workers with funds from the restaurants, and leasing houses for some of the unauthorized workers to live in. Rogel Jimenez and Romero Molina are Mexican nationals who were living in the U.S. without authorization, federal prosecutors said. Several undocumented workers were also arrested on immigration violations, prosecutors said. The undocumented workers were paid below minimum wage and were not compensated for overtime, according to federal prosecutors. The Clustons and Rogel Jimenez and Romero Molina benefited financially from the scheme and did not pay proper employment taxes for the workers, according to federal prosecutors. The Clustons and Rogel Jimenez and Romero Molina pleaded not guilty to all charges on Monday, July 21st, in U.S. District Court of Arizona in Flagstaff, according to court filings. Brenda Clouston was released on her own recognizance, court filings show. A detention hearing for Robert Clouston was set for July 24th. Detention hearings were set for July 28th for Romero Molina and July 29th for Rogel Jimenez, court filings show. Federal prosecutors said the Colt Grill raid capped a three-year investigation, but is part of the Trump administration's aggressive nationwide immigration crackdown. The Colt Grill raid happened a week after federal agents arrested the owner of a West Phoenix taqueria and several food trucks following an immigration raid on July 8th. Vladimir Angula Odebes, 42, owner of the taqueria El Taco Loco restaurants at West Indian School Road and North 67th Avenue, and food trucks in Phoenix, was arrested on charges of harboring unauthorized immigrants, knowingly employing people unauthorized to work in the U.S., improper entry into the U.S., and being an unauthorized immigrant in possession of a firearm, according to federal prosecutors. Angulo, his businesses, and his associates were under surveillance for nearly 5 months, from March through July 2025, according to federal court records. Chukri, the Arizona Restaurant Association president, said restaurant owners need not worry if they are complying with state and federal employment and hiring laws. That includes requiring all prospective employees to complete federal I-9 employment eligibility verification forms and keeping those forms on file for possible inspection by the proper authorities, Chukri said. Under the 2008 Legal Arizona Workers Act, employers are also required to use the federal government's E-Verify electronic verification system to check the work eligibility of all new hires. What we've been telling restaurant owners is to make sure that they're going through the I-9 process as well as the E-Verify process and all the proper protocols and hiring procedures, and that then they should be fine, Chukri said. The recent restaurant raids in Arizona come amid growing complaints from agriculture and hospitality industry leaders that the Trump administration's increasingly aggressive immigration raids and arrests are taking away workers that are difficult to replace. In June, President Donald Trump acknowledged the immigration crackdown was hurting farmers and the hospitality and leisure industries and suggested changes were coming. But after facing a backlash from immigration hardliners, the crackdown intensified. Chukri said he is hopeful the crackdown will push Congress to take long-awaited action and pass immigration reforms that allow immigrants to work legally rather than illegally. On July 15th, a bipartisan group of 10 Republican and 10 Democratic lawmakers in the House introduced legislation that calls for a nationwide mandate of the E-Verify system and other immigration and border security enhancements, along with providing an opportunity for undocumented immigrants who have been in the U.S. for at least 5 years to earn legal status. What we really need to have happen is the administration and Congress to work together to bring about some form of immigration policy that makes sense and that can put us on a path forward that not only can benefit the restaurant industry, but all industries that need import labor, Chukri said. The next article is titled, Mesa's Rogue Park Rangers Were Top Overtime Recipients. Mesa Park Rangers involved in the Goon Squad investigation were paid in overtime up to 19 times more than the median for full-time park rangers across 7 of Metro Phoenix's largest cities. 3 of the rangers who were disciplined for misconduct were in the top 10 most paid rangers in overtime across the valley. 7 park rangers were placed on leave in April, including 2 who later resigned after an investigation into allegations of criminal activity and wrongdoing, including using racial slurs and targeting homeless people. That included lead ranger Joshua Amato, who was arrested by Mesa police 5 days before he resigned in April. Documents provided to the Arizona Republic showed lead ranger Brandon Montez, ranger Charles Miller, and ranger supervisor Brett Burton were also placed on leave. New details emerged from a 60-page police report, personnel records, training documents, disciplinary actions, and human resource complaints, which the Arizona Republic obtained with a public records request. The Arizona Republic collected, standardized, and analyzed payroll data from cities across the state. Data showed across 7 Valley cities that there were 158 full-time employees with a park ranger job title. The median overtime pay for those rangers was $567. The Goon Squad overtime pay in 2024 was $10,648 for Amato, $8,973 for Miller, and $6,369 for Montez. Amato made the third most in overtime across 7 cities in Metro Phoenix, behind 2 Phoenix park rangers. Miller ranked 5th and Montez ranked 9th. For 2024, Mesa Rangers made a total of $65,567 in overtime pay. Amato, Miller, and Montez accounted for nearly 40% of the total overtime bill for the 16-member unit. Mesa's Parks and Recreation Department's overtime authorization process requires direct supervisor approval and documentation of justification, according to the city. Since Burton, the unit's supervisor, is on leave, the city was limited in its ability to access the detailed records necessary to provide a report for last year's overtime patterns, the city told the Republic in an email. Mesa Ranger overtime made up 7% of pay for fiscal year 2025, which began July 2024 and ended June 2025, the city stated. January had the most overtime hours, amounting to 270, according to data provided by the city. That cost the city $16,303. In total, during the fiscal year ending in June 2025, the Park Rangers Department billed more than 1,650 hours of overtime. Overtime hours significantly decreased in May and June after the Park Rangers unit was investigated and members were placed on leave. 7 Mesa Rangers were placed on leave in April after a police investigation that found allegations of misconduct, including targeting black or homeless people with violence, which they called gooning, to mean dealing with the homeless problem, the city confirmed to the Arizona Republic. A 60-page police report found a group of park rangers kept an unreported stolen firearm, used racial slurs and inappropriate use of force, and shared a Goon Squad patch. The allegations came to light after a rookie ranger reported the firearm to Mesa police, which set in motion the investigation. A second internal investigation was also launched by the city. Amato was arrested on April 22nd on suspicion of possession of a stolen firearm. He was put on leave on April 12th, a day after the firearm was reported, according to the city, prompting an internal investigation. He sent a letter of resignation to the Parks and Recreation Department on April 28th. Mesa police referred the case for prosecution, but the Maricopa County Attorney's Office declined to file charges, saying the case lacked a reasonable chance of conviction. After the police investigation, at least 7 park rangers were placed on leave or resigned, including a second ranger who quit in May. The departures make up nearly half of the 16-person team. City records showed Charles Miller and Montez were placed on administrative leave in April, as was Burton a week later. Records provided to the Republic did not identify the other 3 rangers who were placed on administrative leave, nor the second ranger who resigned. Burton began with the city in 2017 and worked his way up from a park ranger, his personal documents showed. In May 2023, he was made a park ranger supervisor. He was praised by the department's executive team for his leadership in his most recent review in June 2024. Some rangers interviewed by Mesa Police in April questioned the team's leadership. Veteran Ranger Robert Shutnick, who had been a Mesa Park Ranger for 27 years, told police things were getting out of control since Amato had joined the unit. He told investigators he thought Burton swept most things under the rug and even empowered them to go beyond the scope of their job, the police report stated. He also told police he didn't trust that Burton would actually take care of any incidents that were brought up by the rookie ranger. 6 months before police investigated the city's rangers unit, 3 goon squad rangers were promoted to leadership positions or given raises. Amato was hired in October 2023, and 2 weeks shy of his 1-year anniversary, was promoted from ranger to lead park ranger, as was Montez. Both started with the rangers on the same day. The 2 were hired at the same time, along with Charles Miller, city documents show. Amato's direct supervisor praised Amato in his first annual performance review. Brian Miller called Amato a seasoned enforcer and stated he had no doubt Amato would continue to thrive in the role. He wrote, "Amato takes initiative on his daily patrols and looks for opportunities in the field that maintain safety and security for the people of Mesa on a daily basis." Personnel records reviewed the rangers' prior work experience. All 4 men placed on leave previously worked for the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. For 6 years between 2015 and 2021, Montez worked as a sergeant for the Corrections Department in Safford. He described his role as managing inmates, supervising officers on shift, and training staff. The remaining 3 men worked at the Florence facility. Burton worked there for about 17 months as a corrections officer in 2016 and 2017. Amato was a corrections officer for 5 years, employed in Florence between 2017 and 2022. His time overlapped with Miller, who also worked as a corrections officer from 2020 to 2023. 2 months after Mesa Police first investigated the unreported gun, the city received an anonymous complaint to its fraud and ethics hotline. The anonymous tipster blamed a new city policy for almost getting 2 park rangers killed and stated a criminal died due to the changes. The complaint stated Parks Department's leadership did not properly plan or train park rangers when policy changes went into effect. The tip was in response to a memo the city issued 2 months earlier. In November, the city attorney's office police legal advisors sent a memorandum detailing how police officers should respond to park ranger calls for service. It was unclear what incident the tipster was referring to. The city attorney and park leadership have created a dangerous situation for park rangers, the tipster wrote. They said park rangers are required to provide a pleasant, safe park environment by being approachable and respectful, the operations manual states. Rangers do not have police powers to arrest people, nor to search and seize private property. They carry stun guns, pepper spray, nightsticks, and handcuffs. Reasonable force may be used to protect personal safety or the safety of other persons, the manual states. Rangers can detain people and write citations. They may dispose of alcohol, and the policies say they should log and impound seized property, but the manual is silent about searching private belongings. It states that rangers are to contact city police for issues that exceed the scope of duties, including conducting well-being checks on intoxicated people. Mesa launched two separate investigations, one police probe into possible crimes against homeless people, and another personnel review looking into alleged misconduct. Both remain ongoing. The next article is titled, A Water Drama in Rio Verde Foothills. Scottsdale leaders refused to consider extending a temporary agreement with their water-strapped neighbors, cementing a year-end deadline for a private water company to build new infrastructure to bring water to the community. EPCOR Utilities Incorporated has until January 1st to finish building its standpipe and get water flowing directly to Rio Verde Foothills. After that, city leaders will shut off their pipes for a second time. It's been almost 2 years since the unincorporated community last found itself cut off from the city's water supply, sparking a months-long water crisis that drew national headlines. The community ultimately inked a deal with Scottsdale to continue using its water, a measure designed to serve as a stopgap while EPCOR builds a water standpipe and a road to it. While EPCOR leaders said the project is on track to be completed on time, ongoing supply chain uncertainties have threatened to prolong construction. Earlier this year, the water company requested a 9-month extension to the existing deal, calling its request a precaution to ensure the community wouldn't be left high and dry again. Scottsdale City Council's approval would have ensured that Rio Verde Foothills maintained access to city water through September 30th, 2026. But both utility and city officials confirmed that Scottsdale would not consider the request. Scottsdale Mayor Lisa Borowski said there was no appetite among council members to hold a public discussion and vote on the matter. The council discussed the request during a closed-door meeting in early July. The basic takeaway was there was no interest in putting this on the agenda at this time, Borowski said, noting that open meeting laws bar councils from deciding or voting on things during such private sessions. The process to place items on a council's agenda varies by city. In Scottsdale, it's generally up to city management and staff. Because that didn't happen, Borowski said she assumed the city manager was not inclined to take the matter up. The city's spokespeople, Kelly Kerset and Holly Peralta, did not respond to emailed questions. Asked for her thoughts on the request, Borowski said she wouldn't have supported an extension, at least not now. "It's just not necessary at this time," she said, adding that she believed EPCOR should have first gone to the Arizona Corporation Commission. "They need to get on it and do the work that needs to be done in order to comply with the project," she said, adding, "There's still time." The utility previously told the Arizona Republic that it would seek approvals from utility regulators to clear the way for the extended deadline, as well as the city's vote. It's unclear whether obtaining those approvals from the Corporation Commission is still possible or worthwhile without Scottsdale's involvement. Spokesperson Rebecca Stenholm said on July 21st that the company wasn't pursuing any other extension requests. "Scottsdale is a great partner, and while we had hoped for a different decision, we respect it," she said in an emailed statement. "It doesn't change our focus, building and bringing the standpipe into service by the end of the year." You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled, "Fireworks Set Off at Gilbert In-N-Out, a Teen Mob Descends on Restaurant." Bridget Vega, a Gilbert resident and community advocate who was present, said she called the police to warn them that a horde of teens would likely descend upon the restaurant near Williams Field Road and Market Street after a massive Saturday night party nearby. Vega and another parent, knowing the In-N-Out to be a popular meeting place for teens before and after parties, decided to stake out the restaurant after seeing party promotions online. She estimated roughly 150 teens were gathered there. A police officer parked near the In-N-Out sat in his car until the first firework was set off about 10:15 p.m., Vega said. He shined his flashlight as he questioned teens, she added. Backup arrived later, she said, and police questioned a group of teens. Some teens approached the officers to report that fireworks had damaged their vehicles, she said. Ultimately, police did not arrest or detain anyone, instead ordering the teens to disperse, she said. Officers directed teens to leave the area after speaking with the restaurant's manager, said Brenda Carrasco, a Gilbert police spokesperson. Two fireworks were ignited on the east side of the parking lot, and police stopped a vehicle initially believed to be connected to the incident, Carrasco said. Officers allowed the vehicle to leave after learning the driver wasn't involved, she said. The officers believed the fireworks may have been illegal based on what they saw, but did not know for certain, Carrasco added. Interviews with witnesses yielded a description of a suspect, Carrasco said. She encouraged anyone with information on the matter to contact police at 480-503-6500 and reference case 25128407. Carrasco asked that parents and guardians be aware of their teens' whereabouts. Anyone under 16 should abide by a 10 p.m. curfew, she said. A midnight curfew was set for those 16 and 17, according to Carrasco. Gilbert Police contacted the property manager to explore additional support for enforcement efforts on their private property, she said. Creating a safe environment is a shared responsibility, and collaboration between the community and local businesses is essential to achieving that goal, Carrasco said. In-N-Out Burger did not respond to a request for comment. The restaurant is also its own property manager. According to Angela Manka of Vestar Development, which developed and manages Santan Village Marketplace, where the restaurant is located. The incident was another example of teens showing disregard for the law with zero consequences from Gilbert police, Vega said. They knew cops were there, Vega said. They were very brazen, so I'm not shocked of how Gilbert Police Department handled it, because I think they continue to undermine the severity of teen violence. A private security guard was inside the restaurant at the time, but his job seemed limited to crowd control within the establishment as opposed to what was going on in the parking lot, Vega said. Unless Gilbert police adopted more aggressive enforcement measures that demonstrated law-breaking had consequences, teens would continue to run rampant, Vega said. She added she was frustrated with the Gilbert Police Department's monitoring of the In-N-Out, given the restaurant's history as a site of multiple assaults. Officers responded to the restaurant on the evening of July 5th after receiving reports of a fight among girls in the parking lot. Police ultimately arrested two teen girls, a 15-year-old and a 16-year-old, on suspicion of assault and disorderly conduct, with the younger girl also facing a curfew violation charge, police said. The July 5th fight was the most recent assault in a tally of Gilbert In-N-Out beatings. The restaurant was a favorite hangout of the Gilbert goons and the site of seven parking lot attacks, according to beating videos, interviews, and police records. Fireworks have been used in previous incidents involving teens in Gilbert. In one instance, members of a group of teens dubbed the Morrison Ranch Marauders were accused of lighting fireworks that burned a family's barn to the ground with 11 kids inside. Jenny Jones, who owned the barn, accused Gilbert officials of withholding information related to the case. Gilbert leaders, in response, defended the integrity of city staff and said public allegations of a cover-up were silly and unfounded. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article titled, Epstein Case Could Remain Tricky for GOP, written by Savannah Kuchar. Republican lawmakers continue to debate a response to the Jeffrey Epstein dilemma that has roiled the MAGA base and equally frustrated President Donald Trump, while the 2026 midterm elections loom as a potential outlet for their voters to take out some of that vitriol. There are no easy answers to a complicated and dated criminal case from which an ample number of conspiracy theories have emerged. Some conspiracy theories about the case were touted by members of Trump's administration before their government employment. The debate around the disgraced financier and the Justice Department's recent review of his case, which found no evidence of a highly speculated client list or that Epstein had not committed suicide in 2019, has left Republicans in Congress between a Trump rock and a MAGA hard place. A very large group of Americans that have been concerned about this issue, that thought the administration or thought that Republicans were issuing a promise in good faith, are now realizing that perhaps they aren't operating as honestly as they perhaps had appeared, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, told USA Today. The erosion of trust is something that once you lose, it's very difficult to get back, she said. Tensions over how to address the Epstein case have engulfed the GOP-led House and threatened to backlog other legislative priorities. This week, the House Oversight Committee agreed to subpoena testimony from Ghislaine Maxwell, a longtime Epstein aide serving a 20-year prison sentence for conspiring with the financier in sex trafficking. At the same time, pressure to address the Epstein scandal before the entire House prompted Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, to cut the chamber's schedules short and send lawmakers home a day early for their beloved summer breaks that serve as a vital opportunity for lawmakers to reconnect in person with constituents. Trump, who has a long personal history with Epstein, has asked members of his party to move on from the issue and called supporters who do not weaklings. Many GOP supporters are calling the Trump administration's review of the Epstein case insufficient. The case butted into business on Capitol Hill as lawmakers worked to pass Trump's push for $9 billion in spending cuts to public broadcasting and foreign aid. Even after House leadership managed to temporarily quell dissent and see the budget measure through, lawmakers returned to Washington this week, with some as irate as ever. "I would like the House to follow order. That would be really nice," Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, told USA Today. "We should probably be voting on all our appropriation bills, and we're not. So there's a lot of things I would like to see done." Johnson said on July 21st there would not be a vote on anything Epstein-related, saying he wants to give the Trump administration space to address the issue first. His comment underscored how House operations are at something of a standstill, with the tension still caught on a controversial, years-old criminal case. "I think he's scared. I think he's terrified," Representative Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, said of Johnson on July 21st. Massie has spearheaded a bipartisan effort with Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat of California, to force the administration's hand in publicizing files. "Republican voters were promised this. They expected this, and it's not happening," Massie said. But at the same time, he feels an allegiance to President Trump, who's gone against the MAGA base on this. "So I think he's torn." Disputes in the House are unfolding ahead of a 5-week break from Washington. Lawmakers will head home to their states and districts, and Republicans are expecting to face some scrutiny from disgruntled constituents. A Reuters Ipsos poll taken July 15th and 16th found 69% of Americans believe the federal government is hiding details about Epstein's clients. A Quinnipiac University poll around the same time found 63% of voters disapprove of how his administration is handling the issue. Republicans this year have already faced heated town halls back home, prompting leadership to encourage members to quit holding events. "There are a lot of people here in the swamp who think that, oh well, if we spend 5 weeks on vacation, the pressure for this will dissipate," Massie said. "I don't think it's going to dissipate. I think it's going to build." Democrats didn't put the Epstein matter into the public domain, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said in a press conference on July 14th. "This was a conspiracy that Donald Trump, Attorney General Pam Bondi, and these MAGA extremists have been fanning the flames of for the last several years, and now the chickens are coming to roost. Democrats already have the historical edge next November, as the party that does not hold the White House typically performs better in midterm elections. Both Democratic and Republican presidents suffered stinging defeats that led to them losing one or both chambers of Congress during the 1994, 2006, 2010, 2018, and 2022 campaign cycles. For the 2026 elections, Democrats say they plan to hit their GOP opponents with recent controversial moves, including Trump's sweeping tax policy and spending bill that could affect millions of Americans' Medicaid coverage, as well as the cuts to public broadcasting and global programs. Epstein may be one more name on their list of talking points, and Republicans such as Massey are sounding the alarm now. It will follow each individual Republican through the midterms. It will follow people into their primaries, Massey said. Did you support transparency and justice, or did you come up here, get elected, and fall into the swamp? The next article is entitled, United Nations Court Issues Landmark Opinion. The United Nations' highest court on July 23rd told wealthy countries they must comply with their international commitments to curb pollution or risk having to pay compensation to nations hit hard by climate change. In an opinion hailed by small island states and environmental groups as a legal stepping stone to make big polluters accountable, the International Court of Justice said countries must address the urgent and existential threat of climate change. States must cooperate to achieve concrete emission reduction targets, said Judge Yuji Ishiwara, adding that failure by countries to comply with the stringent obligations placed on them by climate treaties was a breach of international law. The court said countries were also responsible for the actions of companies under their jurisdiction or control. Failure to rein in fossil fuel production and subsidies could result in full reparations to injured states in the form of restitution, compensation, and satisfaction, provided that the general conditions of the law of state responsibility are met. I didn't expect it to be this good, Vanuatu's climate minister Ralph Reginvanu told reporters after the unanimous opinion by the ICJ, also known as the World Court, was read out. Vishal Prasad, one of the law students that lobbied the government of Vanuatu in the South Pacific Ocean to bring the case to the ICJ, said, "This advisory opinion is a tool for climate justice, and boy, has the ICJ given us a strong tool to carry on the fight for climate justice." UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres hailed the opinion and said it affirms that the Paris Climate Agreement goals need to be the basis of all climate policies. "This is a victory for our planet, for climate justice, and for the power of young people to make a difference," he said. "The world must respond." Iwasawa, who presided over the panel of 15 judges, said that national climate plans must be of the highest ambition and collectively maintain standards to meet the aims of the 2015 Paris Agreement that include attempting to keep global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. Under international law, he said, the human right to a clean, healthy, and sustainable environment is essential for the enjoyment of other human rights. While the decision was stronger than most expected, its impact may be limited by the fact that the United States, the world's biggest historical greenhouse gas emitter and second biggest current emitter behind China, has moved under President Donald Trump to undo all climate regulations. As always, President Trump and the entire administration is committed to putting America first and prioritizing the interests of everyday Americans, White House spokesperson Taylor Rogers told Reuters in response to the opinion. With skepticism over climate change spreading in the United States and elsewhere, Iwasawa laid out the cause of the problem and the need for a collective response in his two-hour reading of the court's opinion. Greenhouse gas emissions are unequivocally caused by human activities that are not territorially limited, he said. Historically, rich industrialized countries have been responsible for the most emissions. Iwasawa said these countries need to take the lead in addressing the problem. The court's opinion is non-binding, but it carries legal and political weight, and future climate cases would be unable to ignore it, legal experts said. This is the start of a new era of climate accountability at a global level, said Denio Garrido, legal counsel for Greenpeace. Harj Narula, a lawyer specializing in climate litigation and counsel for the Solomon Islands in the case, said the ICJ laid out the possibility of big emitters being successfully sued. These reparations involve restitution, such as rebuilding destroyed infrastructure and restoring ecosystems, and also monetary compensation, he said. The July 23rd opinion follows 2 weeks of hearings last December at the ICJ, when the judges were asked by the UN General Assembly to consider two questions. What are countries' obligations under international law to protect the climate from greenhouse gas emissions? And what are the legal consequences for countries that harm the climate system? Developing nations and small island states at greatest risk from rising sea levels had sought clarification from the court after the failure so far of the 2015 Paris Agreement to curb the growth of global greenhouse gas emissions. The UN says that current climate policies will result in global warming of more than 3 degrees Celsius or 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels by 2100. As campaigners seek to hold companies and governments to account, climate-related litigation has intensified, with nearly 3,000 cases filed across almost 60 countries, according to June figures from London's Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. The next article is entitled, World Health Organization Says Gaza Facing Mass Starvation. Gaza is suffering man-made mass starvation caused by a blockade on aid into the Palestinian enclave, World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said on July 23rd. He spoke following an appeal by more than 100 aid agencies warning of hunger in Gaza while tons of food, clean water, and medical supplies sit untouched just outside the territory. I don't know what you would call it other than mass starvation, and it's man-made, and that's very clear, Tedros told a virtual news conference live-streamed from Geneva. This is because of the blockade. Gaza's food stocks have run out since Israel, at war with Palestinian militant group Hamas since October 2023, cut off all supplies to the territory in March, and then lifted that blockade in May, but with restrictions that it says are needed to prevent aid from being diverted to militant groups. As a result, international aid agencies say that only a trickle of what is needed is currently reaching people in Gaza. Israel says it is committed to allowing in aid and has let enough food into Gaza during the war, blaming Hamas for the suffering of Gaza's 2.2 million people. 10 more Palestinians died overnight from starvation, the Gaza Health Ministry said, bringing the total number of people who have starved to death to 111, most of them in recent weeks, as a wave of hunger crashes on the Palestinian enclave. The World Health Organization said the deadly surge in malnutrition has caused the deaths of at least 21 children reported to the agency in 2025, but stressed those figures are likely the tip of the iceberg. Centers for treating malnutrition are full without sufficient supplies for emergency feeding, the World Health Organization added, as the hunger crisis has been compounded by the collapse of aid pipelines and restrictions on access. Tedros also said the United Nations and its humanitarian partners were unable to deliver any food for nearly 80 days between March and May, and the resumption of deliveries was still insufficient. The situation is dire, he and other World Health Organization officials said, with around 10% of people screened experiencing either severe or moderate malnutrition, and up to 20% of pregnant women. In July alone, 5,100 people have been admitted to malnutrition programs, including 800 who were severely emaciated, said Rick Papercorn, the World Health Organization's representative for the occupied Palestinian territories. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.